Welcome to the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange. Today's topic is SSL configuration of the IBM Java EE application clients and the WebSphere application server version 7 service integration bus. Today's presenter is Rich Wanjoy. Rich has worked in IBM customer support for 15 years. He joined the WebSphere MQ support team in 1998 and has been supporting the service integration bus since its initial release in WebSphere Application Server version 6. At this time, I would like to turn the presentation over to Rich.
Welcome. Today I'll be demonstrating the SSL configuration of the Java EE application client to the service integration bus. Joseph, we can move to slide 2, please. First, I'd like to begin by going over our agenda. I'll start with looking briefly at the Java message service, then the service integration bus, followed by the application client launch client tool. We'll then talk about SSL and JSSE and discuss how the application client connects to the SI bus. Slide 3, please. Next, we'll look at a code example of a JMS client and the step-by-step SSL configuration for the application client connecting to SI bus. An example showing the syntax of running the client, followed by a quick look at some tracing outputs, and then close with some useful links and a brief question and answer period. Slide 4, please. What is JMS? The Java Message Service, or JMS, is a Java-based API used to send or receive messages. It is defined by a specification and supports both asynchronous and synchronous communications. The loosely coupled reference means the sender and receiver of the message don't need to know anything about each other. There are two models here. Point-to-point is a one-to-one messaging model where one producer sends a message that is consumed by a single consumer. And publish-subscribe is a one-to-many model where a single publisher produces messages that are consumed by multiple consumers. Slide 5, please. Components of JMS. There are multiple JMS providers available, such as WebSphere MQ and the Service Integration Bus, which we'll look at in a bit, as well as third-party providers. As part of the J2EE and now the Java EE spec, these providers implement the JMS specification. So some of the JMS terms we want to familiarize ourselves with are JMS clients. When I say JMS clients, I'm talking about just an application that sends and receives messages to and from destinations. Messages, these are the objects that contain the data transfer by the client. And administered objects, these are objects defined in a JNDI namespace that JMS clients use for configuration details. And so we're talking about connection factories and destinations here. Slide 6, please. What is a service integration bus? It's a lot of things, but briefly, just a high level. Each Java EE application server is required to provide a default JMS provider. The service integration bus is the default provider for WebSphere 6 and onwards. Previously at WAS 5, we used Embedded MQ as the provider, which was not a pure Java implementation, which we are now. SIB supports the JMS 1.1 specification and can be described as interconnected message engines that can send and receive messages to each other. And we'll look at this a little bit closer. Slide 7, please. Components of a bus. So a bus can be thought of as a configuration of message engines and destinations. When you create a bus, you really don't have anything useful until you add a server or cluster of servers as bus members. Once you do that, one or more message engines are created. And the message engines are really the runtime component that does the work sending and receiving messages to and from destinations. It's worth mentioning that each message engine will have an associated message store for persistent data. This can either be a file on disk or a schema in a database. Slide 8, please. What is the IBM Java EE application client? The application client is a WebSphere client provided with the WebSphere application server install that allows you to run JMS applications in the Java EE client container. Application servers have various containers, EJB web and client, for example, and these containers provide all sorts of good stuff for you, such as security, database access, JNDI lookups, and transaction support. Containers are applications themselves under the covers and are the interface between the components and the low-level platform-specific functionality for that component. To do this, the client application needs to be assembled into a JEE application and deployed into the container, and we'll see an example of this later on. Slide 9, please. Launch Client. Launch Client is the tool we use to kick off the environment for the client container and is started with the Launch Client script. Here is a syntax and usage example, which we'll look at more later. Keep in mind there are multiple copies of the Launch Client script out in the app server and app client directory structure. If there are multiple profiles configured in your WebSphere installation, then Launch Client needs to include the dash profile name pname argument. This tells Launch Client where to look for property files used to configure the client. And these would be the ssl.client.props file and ssl.client.ssl.properties file, which we'll use later on. So the dash profile name defines the profile of the application server process in a multi-profile installation. And the dash profile name option is not required for running in a single profile environment or in an application installation, application client installation. The dash JVM options are the valid Java standard or non-standard option string. You just insert quotation marks around the option string. The dash help prints the usage information. And the user app.ear is the path and name of the ear file containing the client application. The dash CCs listed there are the client container arguments, which we'll look at next. Slide 10, please. The launch client parameters. The launch client tool uses dash CC parameters for configuration details. I listed the URL at the bottom showing the help information with a list of them, and they are also listed in detail in the information center. These are just a few of the ones that we might be interested in. The bootstrap host and port or the host and port where you want to connect to. The dash CCD allows you to configure Java system properties. The dash CC provider URL provides bootstrap information if you're using JNDI. Corba object URLs, you know, keep in mind, are more flexible than IIOP URLs and are their recommended URL format. Also worth noting that this value can contain more than one bootstrap server address. So you can specify multiple bootstrap server addresses, for example, all servers in a cluster, and the operation will work if at least one of the servers is running, which eliminates a single point of failure. Also worth noting that the address list does not process in a particular order. And if you set the provider URL, it's going to override if you also happen to set dash CC bootstrap host and bootstrap port. Those are going to be overridden. And you don't need to set both. It's really one or the other. And as you'll see, we use provider URL in our example. And the dash CC trace and trace file are just optional. If you ever have to trace the launch client, this is how you would do it. So you can use the provider URL or you can use bootstrap host or bootstrap port. Let's go to slide 11, please. And this is just a look at our agenda again, and we'll move on to SSL and JSSE. Okay, if we can move to slide 12, please. What is SSL? Secure Sockets Layer is a standard for secure communications. It uses public key encryption in combination with certificates and certificate authorities for transport layer security. You'll see references to SSL and TLS. WebSphere supports both of those. There are different versions of each. TLS 1.2 is the latest, and the Information Center details in more detail than I can here. But for our purposes, SSL and TLS are often used interchangeably, and but we can think of them as the same thing in this presentation. TLS is based on SSL 3.1, but again, for our purposes, when I say TLS, I mean SSL. When I say SSL, I mean TLS. Slide 13, please.
What is JSSE? Java Secure Socket Extensions provide transport layer security for Java by providing an API for a Java version of SSL relying on certificate-based key pairs. It's an interface between an application and a set of packages that implement SSL. So in short, you're going to have a JSSE provider that implements SSL. ECPO 509 is a specification for public key infrastructure, and it's the most widely used standard for digital certificates. I have a link at the end for the JSSE reference guide, which gives great detail on JSSE, more than I could hear. But in short, just think of JSSE as Java's way to do SSL. Slide 14, please. Now for some SSL terminology. When we talk about key stores, these are the files on disk that hold the public and private keys used to encrypt and decrypt data. Trust stores hold your public keys for the remote side. So, for example, the key store will be used for encryption and signing something with your private key, and the trust store holds the signer certificate to authenticate the remote side. Digital certificates allow verification that the person sending the data is who they claim to be. Personal certificates are like a digital ID card that can be used to verify you are who you say you are. CA certificates are used to sign other certificate requests, and public-private keys are used during the SSL handshake to encrypt and decrypt data. Public keys are stored as signer certificates and sent to the clients that request them. Private keys are stored in the personal certificate, and they're never sent to others. You've got to keep those private. Session keys encrypt and decrypt data flowing over the connection. And self-signed certificate, which we will use, is a certificate that has signed itself, essentially, basically vouching for itself, and is used for testing purposes. Ciphers are just the algorithms for authentication. Slide 15, please. So if you go out on the web and look, you're going to see a lot of different examples of the SSL handshake. Here's one that I think is probably pretty reasonable. The client sends a request to the server asking for a secure connection, and the server sends back a reply with the server certificate with its public key, and the client verifies the server certificate. The server can optionally request the client to send a certificate to be authenticated by the server. So when the client verifies the certificate was sent by a trusted party, like a CA authority, it then uses the server's public key to encrypt the data, which is used by each end to create identical secret keys. These secret keys are used to create the session keys, which encrypt and decrypt the data going across the wire. Then the client tells the server that all the future messages will be encrypted by the session key and vice versa. Slide 16, please. So what do I really get with SSL? In support, we kind of like this PAIN acronym as a little memory aid. It gives us an encrypted connection. We can verify the other side's identity. We can make sure the data hasn't been messed with. And you can't say you didn't send me this because I know you did. That's what we get with SSL. Slide 17, please. Connecting into SIB. We're going to talk about bootstraps, transport chains, and endpoints here. With JMS, you use connection factories as a template to build connections, and these connection factories are typically looked up in a JNDI namespace with details about the bus, destination, and transport chains. It is probably easier to work our way backwards. Endpoints, like the SIB endpoint address and SIB endpoint secure address, are really ports associated with transport chains. And we provide two for SIB, inbound basic messaging, which is not using SSL, and inbound secure messaging, which is using SSL. Slide 18, please. Provider endpoints. JMS client applications running inside WebSphere are able to communicate with WebSphere to see where message engines are running. JMS clients running outside of WebSphere can't do that. You have to tell them where the message engine is running. And the way you do that is they use provider endpoints. So the provider endpoints on the connection factory show you where to bootstrap to the SIB service. And this is in triplet form of host name port and transport chain. This SIB service keeps track of where the message engines are running and manages the transport chains for you. Each application server has one and only one SIB service, which is disabled by default. And when you add a server or a cluster as a bus member, this causes the message engine to be created, and a SIB service is automatically enabled on the JVM. But you can disable it if you had a reason to. So in short, you bootstrap to the SIB service to find out where to connect to the message engine, and this is set on the provider endpoint for the connection factory. And again, like if you set hostname 7276 bootstrap basic messaging, that would mean that you were bootstrapping without using SSL. And if you did hostname 7286 bootstrap secure messaging, means you'd be bootstrapping with SSL, you know, if you had it configured. Slide 19, please. Port values. Here's just an example from the admin console showing the ports for a server. You can see the defaults for a SIB endpoint address and SIB endpoint secure address, which are the ports for the SIB service, or the ports that the SIB service is listening on. The bootstrap address at the top is where you set the provider URL via the -cc provider URL parameter we saw earlier to get the JNDI initial context. This example uses 2810, but our example later will use 2809. Slide 20, please. Just another quick peek at our agenda. Now we're going to take a look at the SSL connection configuration to SIB and an example of using Launch Client. Slide 21. So if we take a quick look at our client sample, typically with a JE application, we do doing something with EJBs, but I just wanted something simple here to demonstrate SSL rather than focusing on that. Keep in mind you could specify the provider URL programmatically. Not recommended because that makes it, you know, not portable. And we're going to be specifying with the -cc, as I mentioned. This initial code shows the connection factory lookup of the JMS client CF connection factory and the JMS client queue destination. Slide 22, please. Here we have the connection and the send. The producer and message are created off the session object. I just noticed the com.start, you don't really need that for sending a message. I had taken this sample from a consuming app and kind of built off of it and accidentally left that in there. But it's not hurting anything, but I'll make sure I get that out of there. JMS has five message types. Here we are using text message for the string. And then we send a message. Slide 23, please. Here we're just closing the connection and doing some exception handling. So just to summarize, from the connection we get the session, and the session is used to create producers and consumers, and from those we can send or receive the message. Slide 24, please. It was tough to kind of get a summary of how to build the ear and fit it in this presentation. You can almost do a whole presentation on that itself. But you can build JE apps by hand, but everyone uses tooling like Eclipse to do this. And here are the steps to build the ear file that I used, which we'll use to launch clients. Again, I used Eclipse Helios, and that's available at www.eclipse.org/Helios. And when you download and install that, you just create a new application client project, and you fill in the project name and check the box for add project to ear, then finish. When you expand the new project, you drag the JMS client source we just looked at under the app client module default package. Right-click on the top-level project and select Build Path, then Config Path, then click the Libraries tab, select Add External Jars. If you browse the WAS install directory to add the j2e.jar from the app client lib directory. Then you change the main class in the meta-INF file to point to JMS clients, and then you just export the project as an ear file, and I name mine test1 or testapp1.ear. Slide 25, please. So I didn't have room to go into showing how to create buses and all that. That would just take up too much time, even though it's fairly simple to do. But I wanted to give you a starting point of where I'm at when we start doing the SSL config. I have links at the end, by the way, if you're not familiar with setting this up. But on a Linux server, I created a bus with server 1 as a bus member, and this bought me a message engine. I then created a destination called TestQueue. And I created a JMS connection factory and queue in JNDI named JMS Client CF and JMS Client Queue, respectively. The JMS Client Queue in JNDI resolves to the actual destination test queue. Slide 26, please. SSL configuration. Now we'll begin the trek through the admin console for the SSL configuration. In the admin console, the server SSL configuration has a key stores and certificates option on the right side. Please note the manage endpoint security configurations in the middle and the SSL configurations on the right, as we'll use these a little bit later on. Slide 26, please. So the first thing we're going to do is create the server store. You can create a separate store file for the trust store and the key store, or you can combine them in a single store. Remember, the path is a fully qualified path, and I entered a password, and the type I chose is JKS, which is a Java-specific key store. We could have used another one, and I'll show you that for the client later. At the bottom of each of these admins console pages, when you configure something, there's an apply button there, and you'll need to click on that and then click save to save it in the master configuration. I didn't have room to include that here, but just keep in mind when you make changes in there, you're going to have to save those changes each time. Slide 28, please. So we've got the server store created. Now we're going to create the client store. We do the same thing. I selected PKCS12 just to be different, and it's not specific to Java, meaning it can be read by other applications, but that's really the only difference that I know of. Next slide, please. Slide 29. So now we have the configured stores. We could have used OpenSSL or even GSKit that comes with WebSphere MQ to create these, but you know, we get GSKit with WAS, so why not use it? And keep in mind the client store will need to be copied over to the client machine so it's available for launch client. Slide 30, please. Creating certificates. So when we click on the server store, we can create certificates. And you can see the details of the server store we created, the path, and the store format of JKS. We want to create a self-signed personal certificate. So we click on personal certificates on the right. Slide 31, please. Creating a self-signed certificate for the server. Select create a self-signed personal certificate. The alias here is the name the key store is going to know the certificate as. And the fields in color are mandatory. Common name is usually a host name where the certificate resides, but I just put in IBM. Slide 32, please. And here we're displaying the server self-signed certificate. You can see the validity period and the algorithm used for the signature, the CN, the location, the stuff I entered earlier. Slide 33, please. So we have the self-signed certificate for the server. Now we need to do the same thing for the client. We'll create the self-signed personal certificate just like we did for the server. Slide 34, please. Here's the client's personal certificate. It looks similar to the server's. You're probably not going to use self-signed certificates beyond testing. Typically, you'd send a request to a CA authority like VeriSign or GlobalSign, who is in business to verify you are who you say you are, then they send you back a certificate to use. Slide 35, please. Exchanging signers. After we have the two stores created, each with a personal certificate, we next select the option to exchange signers. As you'll see on slide 29, this brings us to this screen. You highlight each cert on the left and click Add to add the signer. So now the server side has the client signer and the client store has the server signer, which means the client can trust the server and the server can trust the client. Slide 36, please. So at this point, we've got the two stores created. We've got the self-signed certificates in each, and they have each exchanged the signers. So the next step now is to create an SSL configuration. This SSL config will be tied to a transport chain, as you'll see in a bit. So in our example, we used the creative name of test SSL config. We'll point the key store and trust store to our store file and select the certificate alias. As you can see, we could have specified different key stores and trust stores if we had created these separately, but I'm using the same one here. The QOP option allows you to specify if you want the server to authenticate the client, and we'll see that in a bit. Next slide, please. 37. Enable client authentication. So here's the client authentication I just mentioned. Required means the server requests a certificate from the client. Supported means it may request a certificate. And none means it will not request anything. So for our MQ friends, this is like SSL CAuth required or optional on the channel. The protocol specifies the secure socket layer handshake protocol. And typically it's going to use SSL underscore TLS, which supports all handshake protocols except for SSL V2 on the server side. When you have FIPS enabled, which is the United States Federal Information Processing Standard, transport layer security is automatically used regardless of the setting. But again, the default protocol SSL TLS supports, you know, TLS version 1, SSL version 3, and so on. And it's going to negotiate the highest between the two sides, between the client and the server. Slide 38, please. So managing endpoint security configurations. So now we want to tie the SSL configuration to an inbound and outbound connection. On the first SSL configuration page, you're going to see the option there that I mentioned earlier about managing endpoint configuration. It is inside of there where you pick the inbound and outbound endpoints and pin the SSL config to them. Once you select your SSL config from the drop-down, you just click to update the alias list and select the certificate alias. Slide 39, please. So after you do that, here's a slide that shows you the configured endpoints of the server. And it's what the configured inbound and outbound endpoints look like. Prior to the steps, the server would have shown the default SSL settings for those servers. But now that we have made the changes, you can see that we have the test SSL config there. And so you can see that test SSL config with the alias that's listed for server 1. Slide 40, please. And now we get to revisit the provider endpoints and transport chains. And so this is the connection factory for JMS client CF. And if we look at the transport chains and provider endpoints that we talked about earlier, here we have configured a bootstrap using the SSL-enabled transport chain, and subsequent connections to the message engine will be via the secure chain as well. As I mentioned earlier, we didn't have to specify inbound secure messaging for the transport chain, as we default to this with 6.1 onwards. When the 7.2.8.6 Bootstrap Secure Messaging Provider endpoint is used. So on the CF, I could set the transport chain to inbound basic messaging and the provider endpoint to hostname where the SIB service is running, 7.2.8.6 Bootstrap Secure Messaging, and the initial bootstrap to the SIB service would be encrypted, but this is not recommended as the connection to the ME would not be using SSL as the inbound transport chain is not set to use SSL. if you set it this way, then any user ID and password used for authentication to access WAS or SI Bus would be in clear text. So obviously this is a bad idea. So at 6.1, we tried to protect against that. So if the Bootstrap secure messaging is used on the provider endpoints, then inbound secure messaging transport chain is used by default. And it's a good idea to remember, because this is a point of confusion for a lot of people. It's a good idea to remember that transport security, so we're talking SSL here in JMS terms, has nothing to do with bus security or WAS admin security. So you don't have to have those enabled to do SSL. And slide 41, please. And it's not required, but it's a good idea to disable the inbound messaging transport chain if you've got SSL set up. It's considered good practice. And that way you don't have non-secure connections coming in. In the admin console, you can enable or disable these chains. If the inbound basic messaging transport chain is disabled, that means that only SSL connections can come into SIB. And this completes the SSL configuration on the server. At this point, just need to remember to copy the client store over to the client and bounce the app server to pick up the changes, and now everything we're going to be doing will be on the client side. So slide 42, please. When you're configuring the client container to bootstrap using an SSL-based transport chain, you can specify additional SSL properties in the sib.client.ssl.properties file. This file is located in the app client properties directory of the application client installation. The properties in this file are used for all client container bootstrapping activities. If there's not a whole lot to this file, but if com.ibm.ws.sib.configuration is set to file, then it means read the properties from this file. It means that you've added properties into this file, and this is where we should look for them. If com.ibm.ws.sib.configuration is set to alias, it means go look in the ssl.client.props file for the SSL config that matches what is set for com.ibm.ssl.alias. In addition, you can override or augment properties specified in the sib.client.ssl.properties file by specifying JVM system properties of the same name on the application client. And you do this with that dash CCD command line option that I mentioned earlier. So again, there's not much to this file. The com.ibm.ssl.alias points to the client SSL config. And we can call this anything we like as long as it matches the config in the ssl.client.props file. And that's what we're going to take a look at next. Slide 43, please. So the Information Center goes into a lot of detail on the ssl.client.props file, and I would recommend taking a look at that. And this is the file's a longish file. It has some entries in there for the default SSL config that we're not really concerned about. And so this is just a portion of the file that we're concerned with. As we're using the client SSL config, you know, that's the little stanzas that we're going to be worried about. So to create this config, you edit the file, and if you scan down the file, you're going to see a little section there called another SSL config, which is a template for you to create your config. And we just put in there client SSL config because that's what we said in the other properties file. The entries that I have uncommented, they'll be commented out, are the ones that I've used. So I set enable signer exchange prompt to true because we're going to be doing client authentication. And I added the pass to the key store and trust store with a password. And I kept the IBM JSSE provider. And the protocol of SSL_TLS, as we discussed earlier, means that we'll negotiate with the other side. And so just remember what I uncommented is what I use for the settings. And you can see I had to specify PKCS12 for the store format for the client store. And that's it for that. Slide 44, please. So here's a little summary of all the things that we've done so far. We created the stores. We created the self-signed personal certificates. We exchanged the signers. We created an SSL config for the server and pointed it to the server store. We enabled client authentication. We pointed the provider endpoints to the secure transport chain. We disabled the inbound basic messaging transport chain. We move the client key store trust stores over to the client. We configure the sib.client.ssl.properties to point to the client SSL config. And we modify the SSL.client props with the proper SSL properties. And now we use launch clients to invoke the client, which we'll look at next. Slide 45, please. So finally, we get to launch client. Here we're running from the application client directory structure. If you configure property files from under a profile directory for a local WISE install, then you would again need to specify the dash profile name, pname parameter, and make sure the property files were in the profile's properties directory. The dash cc provider URL points to the hostname 2809 of the Bootstrap server for the JNDI namespace, so we can look up initial contacts. And this is different than the Bootstrap server we talked about earlier for the SIP service, so we've kind of got two different bootstrapping things going on here. And you can see the output of our application where the message is going to the test queue on TuxBus. Slide 46, please. I thought it might be interesting to just throw a little bit of what this looks like in a trace. In the client trace, we can see that if we used SSL splat all, we would have gotten a whole lot of SSL gory details in the trace, so I actually didn't use that. But we can see highlighted in red is the message ID, and then the UOW equals 3-4 stuff is the unit of work ID, and you can use this to follow in the client trace, follow the message down and to the point where it's being sent. Slide 47, please. In the server trace, we'll see the message ID in red again with the destination that the JMS client queue resolves to test queue. And the message engine listed. Again, we could have added SSL splat equals all to the trace to get the SSL stuff in the trace. And generally speaking, if you're not sure what trace string to use on the server side, SIB message trace splat is a good one to try. If you're having a problem and you're not sure which one to use, that's a good starting point if you haven't contacted us yet. Slide 48 again, please. So now we're going to take a look at the queue point in the admin console. Notice the message ID down at the bottom is the same as seen in the client and server traces. It's probably worth mentioning that the client exceptions that you could run into are typically generic in nature and not very clear. If you see messages when running the launch client that complain about the trust store being damaged or not found, or make sure that the path for the stores in the SSL.client.props is correct and that you have the right stuff commented and uncommented. Also, make sure that you have the properties files in the right places. So those are kind of gotchas as far as SSL goes. Slide 49, please. Okay, so now we're at the end here, and here's some useful links, hopefully. We've got a level 2 to do to rework the SIBMustGather, which we'll work on here shortly, so hopefully we'll have this by year end. I included the Information Center link for creating a bus. If this is new to anyone, from that link, you can find links for adding bus members, creating destinations, all that kind of good stuff. And there is some good reading there as well on launch clients. Slide 50, please. JSSE and SSL links. As promised, the JSSE reference guide is great if you want to learn more about JSSE. The advanced security hardening link is by Keith Botsum, who some of you have probably heard speak at conferences and is recognized as the WebSphere security wizard. That's really good. Anything by him is great. I added the security guide and the JSSE SSL MustGather, which the WebSphere support team would find useful for tricky issues that we in SIP support can't sort out regarding SSL. Slide 51. And here we have some more links for deploying applications, the V7 messaging guide, Redbook, the system administration guide, and the info center and the support site URL. Slide 52, please. This chart includes links to a number of sites that provide valuable online resources for WebSphere products. Visit the WebSphere Support Technical Exchange site to learn more about upcoming WebSphere Support Technical Exchange webcasts, like the one you attended today, and access previously recorded presentations. DeveloperWorks offers in-depth technical information. Visit WebSphereUserGroup.org for user group information and more product information. The IBM Education Assistant consists of self-help modules to get new users up to learning curve quickly. The SR tool is for Passport Advantage clients to open, update, and view PMRs online. And the My Notifications link on all product support pages lets you sign up for weekly email updates for products of interest to you. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Joseph.
Thank you, Rich, for a great presentation. At this point in time, Maria, we would like to open the lines for questions.
Our first question comes from Chuck Chang.
Thanks, Rich. I have a couple questions. The first one is I want to know where does SSL setting go on the WebSphere server? I know WebSphere is a file-based configuration repository. So just like at the client side, there is a file called ssl.client.props. I'm just wondering if there's a corresponding file in the server side where I can just take a look without going to the admin console. Can you?
Not that I'm aware of. It's done through the admin console or through WSAdmin scripting.
Okay.
So there's not like a file that you would go out to and just edit and to change your settings, right?
Okay. Thanks. That's my first question. The second question is, do you know a good tool that I can test CMS? Like I can use SID Explorer to test SID site. Is there a counterpart in the CMS domain that I can use to test my CMS settings?
So you just want like a tool to connect to SIB? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I use SID Explorer to do that.
Right.
I know how to do it. But I want a tool that I can put in like CMS connection factory, CMS queues, you know, and send a message, test a message, you're going to get a response, something like that.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So something to kind of automatically build the JMS client for you?
No, just like a tool, like SID Explorer. But my target is not SID. I would point to the CMS interface and maybe and configure like CNDI Bootstrap in order to get all the object information, administrator object information, and kind of send message over and see the queue, stuff like that. It's not a tool that helps me build a client. I just need a testing tool, a CMS testing tool. Am I making sense?
The closest thing that I think what you're talking about, and feel free to, you can shoot me an email after this if this is what you're looking for, but we do have something out there called the JMS Destination Handler. Have you seen that?
JMS Destination.
Right.
I think I did, and I got a problem configuring the CNDI directory. I think it wants to point to a LDAP server directory or something, which has all the objects. So.
Yeah, that's the closest thing I can think of. I think probably the best thing to do is shoot my emails at the front page of that presentation. Shoot me an email and just tell me exactly what you're looking for, and I can see what we have out there for you.
Okay. I will touch base. Thank you.
Yep. Uh-huh.
Our next question is from Balan Pini.
Hi, this is Balanand Pini. I have two questions. My first question is, within the service integration bus, if I'm using one message engine per one bus member in a service integration bus, how many bus members I can have within a cell?
So you're saying that if you have a server as a bus member and you want to create multiple message engines, is there a limit?
What is the limit on how many I can have within a cell, yes.
Well, think about it this way. The typical way of doing it is you add a cluster as a bus member because that gives you HA functionality. So that means that I have a single message engine, and the message engine is going to be running on one of those servers in the cluster at a time. And it would be available to pop up on another server in the cluster if that initial server had problems at any time. The HA manager would just start it on another server in a cluster. Now, that's probably the most common way you would see it. In a workload management situation, you could configure multiple message engines, but that's probably less common than doing the HA configuration. And if you do that, then you lose the whole message ordering thing. And I'm not aware of a limit out there. There's no hard limit on message engines, but I guess, you know, we could probably want to talk to you a little bit and see, you know, if there was a reason why you were scaling up to a large number, that kind of thing. But maybe considering the naming limitations that we have for the 999 in a cluster might be the limit, you know, because that's all we have space for you to configure the number.
Because I do have 40 members within Service Integration Bus in a workload management scenario working right now,
mm-hmm.
and that should not be a problem, right?
That's one of those things that shouldn't be a problem until it is a problem. You know what I mean? there's nothing out there that says, you know, you can't do what you're doing. As long as you're keeping an eye on, you know, the load that you've got going on,
okay.
then you should be okay. But, no, we don't have any best practices out there saying, oh, no, don't go over 10 or anything like that. No.
My second question is, how many messages per second you can have in this scenario with the reliable non-persistence in active within the cell for each message engine?
I have no idea.
Okay, because IBM has said that with a non-reliable, I have a document from IBM, a non-reliable, non-persistent, you can have 24,000 messages per second it can handle. They have given a statement.
Okay.
So I was wondering, if you go through that path, and for a reliable, non-persistent, would it be less or would it be same? What do you feel?
I think it would probably be a little less, but, you know, the problem is that in support, we kind of get out of the whole performance stuff. I mean, we can certainly get with the performance guys and get some measurements for you, but I think the best way to handle this, to give you an accurate answer, because, you know, I would just be throwing something off the top of my head, probably the best thing to do would be to open up a problem.
I did. We did open up a problem with IBM, and we are going with them, and they say that there is a lot of chattering that takes place between the message engines.
Yes.
On a single service integration bus, I'm not talking about the business messages. I'm talking about the IBM code, which actually chats.
Sure, the message engines are all talking to each other, that kind of stuff, yep.
And we did open, and at this point, it's still in process. It's not a big deal, but they do feel that when you have a multiple in WLM, as per the IBM code, it does cause overhead. So we are trying to look at it, which it's not clear to me right now. That's why I was asking these questions.
Right. Probably, I'd say do this rather than take up the call time on this. If you want to shoot me an email, too, with that problem record, I can look into it and talk with the Level 3 team and make sure they're engaged, because they're the ones that probably have to get with the performance folks to give you a reliable answer.
Thanks. That's all I had.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's fine.
Our next question comes from Ajay Kumar.
Just a general question. Like, what kind of issues have you seen on SIB?
Boy, that is a general question. Well, I've got, 30-something I'm looking at right now. Let's see. A lot of the things that we see typically are message engine startup problems. So you've got problems with the message store. And the message store, the ME is not going to start up if it can't get access to the database you have configured or whatever. So those are always big problems, meaning that they're common. You know, someone is, you know, possibly done something with the database connectivity, or they don't really understand how the HA manager stuff manages the message engine startups, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Other things that we see are Western process servers' use of messaging. So, you know, they have buses that they create. They do a lot of stuff with their product. They've got scripts they run to create objects, and they're using messaging, so we have to get involved in those all the time. And then there's, probably message-driven beans are another problem. You know, where you have your applications deployed. Do you have them deployed in their own cluster, which is probably a good idea outside of the messaging cluster, or did you deploy them inside of the messaging cluster? And if you deployed them inside of the messaging cluster, you're probably curious as why you're only getting messages off these message engines and that kind of thing. So, you know, a lot of it is just the learning curve of the product, because it is, even though it's been out there for a few years, it's still, you know, new to people.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, just another question. I mean, what occurred once was in the production, there was a message engine failover. There was a network outage on one of the boxes. There are like two servers in one cluster, a SIP cluster. So a network outage occurred. I mean, this happened occasionally. It happens occasionally, and in this situation, the message engine failover did not take place. It's a network outage message engine failover.
Mm-hmm.
So
what we would probably do in that case is we would probably want to take a look at the system out logs,
right,
to see what error message we had generated. And
right,
depending on the version of WAS that you're using, the behavior could be different. And there are also custom properties that we can set for SIB to change the behavior, to change the timeouts, to change how long we wait for events to happen, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it's tough to tell you exactly what happened without looking at all that stuff, but that's what we would be going for.
From the system out.logs, what I could see was that this was a data store issue. The database was not releasing the logs in a timely fashion.
Right. So there,
and
what you have to do is
keep alive settings to,
yeah,
5 minutes.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So I tried to test that in QA with the TCP keep alive time settings as 5 minutes. And that didn't work in QA.
Well, it should work because that's the recommendations that other customers are working with. So we could take a look at those keep alive settings if you want to send us a PMR and make sure we have those set right. And then if we had to, we could, you know, set some tracing up and see what's going on. But, you know, it does work. That's what customers use, and that's what we say to do in the info center.
Okay. Yeah, I've already set a PMR with IBM.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. That's
mm-hmm.
Our next question comes from Carrie Hugh.
Hello, Rich. I have a question regarding provider endpoints for the connection factory.
Mm-hmm.
In a cluster environment, in this case, the bus number is a cluster instead of a single server. So in this case, the provider endpoints will be pointing to, what's the address and the port need to set up on that connection factory.
Right. You would have them set up to both or any server in the cluster where the ME could be running, right? You would just put them all in a row there. So if you had three servers in your cluster, you'd have three sets of provider endpoints set up there.
Okay. And any sequences, like a order to, like just routing, like randomly? Or
yeah, I think it's going to, right. I think that's what it's going to do.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time, there are no further questions.
Thank you, Miriam. At this time, we will conclude the presentation.